So if you will, grab your scriptures, turn to the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, chapter 12. And that's where this week's portion begins. Well, it goes like this, and you remember the portion is always named for the first unique words that appear in it, and in this case, you got a whole verse and a half before we get to it, because it says, "Ve'yedebar Yahuwah al Moshe," right? And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and le'amar. Here's what he said. Here comes the quote. "Speak unto the children of Israel, saying," and now finally, we get to the place where the words in the portion are named. "If a woman be delivered," or actually it's ki tatsria, when, or if, a woman delivers, and if she bears a man child, then she's unclean for 7 days. It's kind of like the time of nidah, the time of the monthly menstrual impurity. And then we're going to get the other case in a second here too. But let's pause and talk about that for just a second. So we have, and I kind of emphasized this a little bit over last week's teaching when we were connecting a few dots. So I'm not going to make quite as much of a detailed deal of it as I have in the past. But let me just put it this way. Here's another one of those not PC portions, because it's actually going to tell us something that is absolutely verboten to say on Waystream TV today. And that is, well, several things, actually. First, the creator of the universe knows the difference between men and women. Male and female, he created them. He knows little boy babies and little boy baby and little girl babies. Once upon a time, people, before they were dumbed down, used to know that too. And here's the really shocking part. Not only male and female, he created them. And if we read Torah, we find out that he actually does say that there are different things that are required, different commandments, different statutes, different, well, things that are responsibilities and duties, and indeed biological imperatives. Men can't bear children, whether they'd like to or not. And I think that the same is true. Neither can transgendered things, regardless of what Big Brother would tell you. And here comes the key in this week's portion. There are different requirements for how long this period of ritual or uncleanness lasts, depending upon whether the woman delivers a man-child or a girl-child. Imagine that. And there's also something different that's going to happen to the man-child. On the eighth day, says verse 3, he will have the foreskin of his flesh in his thing that qualifies him as a male, will be circumcised. This is called the Bret Milah, and it is a sign. It's an oath. And, of course, over the years and the understanding, I guess this is important to note as well, it's the eighth-day period. I remember years ago seeing when you look at various things that happen with little boy babies in terms of their pain receptivity, how much pain they're subject to, and some of the things that have to do with their immune system and so forth. Really interesting. Science discovers all of these things peak in the right direction on the eighth day, almost like there was a creator that had this worked out in advance. Who could have thought it? This, by the way, too, is one of the things that I'll say, nowhere in Scripture do we see that it is done away with. Now, what we do see is some argument about whether years and years later it can be mandated as a requirement by people who are adding to and subtracting from. But the commandment here is, on the eighth day, the boy baby is to be circumcised. Okay, back to the text. And the woman who has delivered the child, will continue in the blood of purification for 33 days. Touching no hallowed thing, she's not to come into the sanctuary until this time of being set apart for the uncleanness that's associated with bringing new life into the world, isn't that interesting, is fulfilled. What we then see is if she bears a female child, now the first period of impurity, of uncleanness, lasts 2 weeks, which is basically twice as long. Then she continues for 66 days. Let's see, that would be 66 days. When the days of her 66 days. When the days of her purification are fulfilled for a son or daughter, then there's an offering that is brought. For a olah, a lifted up or a burnt offering, it's a lamb first-year lamb, and also a young pigeon for a chatat, a.k.a. a sin offering, unto the door of the tent of the meeting to the priest. He offers it up for her. Then she is cleansed from this fountain of blood that's associated with the childbirth. This is the Torah, it says, for her that bears, whether it's a male or a female. Oh, and by the way, and this is what we see for the case of the Mashiach, when he too and his parents go through the precise procedure that's listed here, if she is not a wealthy person, if her means do not suffice for that lamb, the one that is to be offered up as an olah offering, then a turtle dove can replace it. So either two turtle doves or two pigeons in this case. And then it says at the end of this time, she shall be clean. Now here's where I pause and say, you know what? This is a really fascinating Torah portion, and also people say, well, this is boring, this is old, this is done away with, this doesn't apply for so many reasons. And of course, whenever I see something that I say this doesn't apply, I tend to say, well, then I better take another look, because obviously I'm missing something here. And I think that's key to a whole lot of the Torah. If we will actually take the things that we think are the most boring and the most, they don't matter anymore, and look more deeply into them, it's amazing what we can find. It's almost like the Creator knew that too and put some blessings in there for those that are willing to diligently seek Him out. And I'm going to start this way by saying that chapter 13, the next part of this, and by the way, it's not going to be over this week. We're going to talk about a little bit more along these same lines next week, has to do with something, and I'm going to generally tend to use the Hebrew word. Here's one of those places where I think the Hebrew word is not just better than the English word. It is a whole heck of a lot misleading. Because if you use the standard English word, I'm going to tell you, as far as I know, it is just plain wrong. Wrong. Because what you're going to think is, well, chapter 13 has to do with leprosy. And the answer is no, not really. What's called a leper, what you'll also hear referred to as Hansen's disease, does not at all seem to be the same thing as what is called zara'at here. So let me read the English the way that it makes more sense, and I'll come back, pause for a second, and we'll lay out some dots prior to the connection. Chapter 13 says, "And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and unto Aaron, and he said the following, when a man shall have in the skin of his flesh a rising, or a scab, or a bright spot," sounds delightful, right? "And it becomes in the skin of his flesh the plague," and that word there is nagah, "the plague of zara'at." Notice I avoided that word that the English mistranslates. "Then he's to be brought before Aaron the priest or unto one of his sons," other Kohanim. And basically what we're going to see in the process here is this, the priest, the Kohen, is going to look upon this negah in the skin of his flesh, and there are a whole lot of descriptions. That's essentially what the rest of the chapter is about. And indeed, the next few chapters are going to be about aspects of this and commentaries on the fact that this stuff, this zara'at, can happen in other places besides people. And that, too, is kind of interesting. Here's where I pause. By the way, as always, if there are questions or comments, put them on the screen. Remember, there's a little bit of a lag, but I will try to get to those, especially this evening. I'm not sure that I can answer everything, but what's fascinating about it is that whatever this zara'at is, we don't know anymore, it would seem. It's gone. And the question, of course, lots of questions, why and what are some of the connections? Well, those all have to do with the dots that we're going to go through in just a minute. Here's how I start this out, though. The way the portion starts out. We got chapters 12, 13, and 14. Actually, it ends at the beginning of chapter 14. And that's all that's in here. So what do we got here? We got, think about this for a second. Speak to the children of Israel. We're talking about a time when a woman delivers a baby. Man, child, or woman, child. And if you think about it, that's a joyful occasion. It's also an occasion when, what? Life begins. New life comes into the world. And there is, in fact, some uncleanness that's associated with it to the extent that there is an afterbirth and there are things that are associated with blood that's involved. So there's a lot of, well, instruction that the Torah provides about what we do during this time of bringing new life into the world. And then isn't it interesting? Very next thing that they talk about is this nagah, this plague that, well, no, it's not quite leprosy, but I'll tell you what. No question about it. What it sounds like is being described here. Scabs, bright spots, flesh rising, various kinds of hair in them, scabs that spread, that grow, and that do various kind of unsavory sounding things. Certainly, if you go back and look at Scripture, you remember that the first time that it seems to be described was Miriam, Moshe's sister. She turned literally deathly white. Oh, there's the key word. It does, in fact, look a whole lot like this thing, this plague called Zaraat, has a whole lot more in common with just plain old death than it does even Hansen's disease or leprosy. Not that those things don't all kind of have a little bit of a similar smell to the idea of death. But I'm going to contend that is the key to understanding all of this, is to recognize that somehow or other, Zaraat seems to have a whole lot to do with death. All right, that brings me to the other thing that people will note, besides the fact that, oh, this doesn't matter to us anymore. And certainly, when you look at some of the prescriptions here, some of the things that the priest does, some of the ways that the offerings are made and how this is to be cleaned up. Well, as I heard one rabbi put it not long ago, this is bizarre. This is bizarre stuff. And especially if we don't see it anymore, it makes it seem even more bizarre. Now, one of the other things, of course, if you've been familiar with the various midrashim on this, the things that have been written and discussed about this particular portion of the Torah, there is almost a universal understanding. And for a while, I had some difficulty with this. The more times I go through it, the more times I read it, the more times I connect the dots, this is one of those places where I'd say, okay, I can't prove it to you from Scripture beyond any shadow of a possible doubt, but I certainly increasingly accept that, no doubt about it, to my mind, okay, the markology, your mileage may vary, but at least I have become convinced that there is a lot of truth when people say, yep, this is a spiritual malady. Somehow or other, this thing that is called Zaraat is very much associated with a spiritual condition. And by the way, the closest I can probably come to a proof we're going to go through a bit of tonight, but it's that word nagah, plague. And when you understand when the words are used and how essentially there's a promise in Scripture, blessings for obedience, curses for rebellion. And one of the things that we can remember is, hey, if you will do the things I tell you to do, none of the plagues that were brought upon Egypt. We're going to talk specifically about one of them that was associated specifically with death, as a matter of fact, will befall you. So it's not hard to at least to find a whole lot of circumstantial evidence, if you want to call it that, that certainly implies this is a spiritual malady. All right, next step, and I suspect most people have heard this as well. It's associated with some specific things. I've seen the list of things that the rabbis say, can bring about Zaraas, including murder and some other really nasty things. But of course, the one that most people that have been around the Torah for a few years and read through would probably know, maybe even remember the Hebrew words for, Lashon Hara. It is generally taught that the Metzora, the person who has, that's the name for the person who has this, this plague, this malady, Zaraat, possibly committed the sin of Lashon Hara. What's Lashon Hara? Well, literally it means the evil tongue. It is, well, how about this? It's associated with murder by the tongue. That's the connection with murder and with death. It's all of these kind of things that when I look at and study and go back and reread, I say, okay, you just can't help but eventually come to the conclusion that there is a whole lot of, dots, pieces that fit. When you begin to say, okay, does look like Lashon Hara, the evil tongue, is in fact associated with Zaraat. Maybe that's part of the understanding that we're going to come back to a few times. Why it is that we don't see it anymore, I guess if it was, well, how many shows can you think of that are on TV that are gossip, right? I don't know. Somebody tell me, is a show that I remember called Gossip Girl? I haven't looked in a long time. Is that still on TV? But, you know, you could call it Zara Ott Girl, Metzora. But no. In other words, we've got an entire society that seems to thrive on things that had there still been Zara Ott, lots of people would be dropping over and there wouldn't be any place to go outside of the camp because the whole stinking camp is full of unclean, unclean, unclean. And maybe that, too, speaks volumes to us. So I'm going to go back and we're going to talk about a few of the things that are specific to some of the well, the things that the priest does. In years past, I've told a joke. I guess since I mentioned it, I ought to tell the joke briefly. And the joke has to do with umpires in baseball, in a bar. Okay, and you're going to say, what the heck does that have to do with Zara Ott and leprosy, or not calling it that, the evil tongue and so forth. It has to do with the way the priest is the one who basically declares, pronounces, that this is Zara Ott. And that, too, is kind of fascinating. There's this this understanding in the Word that it's the priest that makes the determination. He pronounces this person to either have this thing or later pronounces them to be unclean. Even in the case where we see that Yeshua heals somebody who's got it, then, go show yourself to the Kohen and follow through with the rest of the procedure. All right, so here's the kind of silly joke. There's three umpires sitting in a bar, and they're arguing about who's the greatest umpire, right? And one of them says, "I calls him as I sees him," talking about, you know, he's the one that can tell whether it's a ball or a strike. The second umpire looks at him and guffaws and says, "Ha! I calls him as they are." And the third umpire looks, and he's going to one-up both of them, and he says, "No, you guys don't get it. They ain't nothing until I calls them." And there's kind of the essence of Zara Ott. It may or may not be anything, but it is the priest that pronounces it, both as the plague of Zara Ott and also when it's clean. Now, at least the priest has some guidance, and that's what we're going to see here in chapter 13. Let me read just a couple more verses to kind of give you the feel for it. And there are all kinds of prescriptions about what happens and what happens here and then what happens next. And I don't know that we need to go through all of those. I guess if I was a Kohen, I would say keep this one handy until you've pretty well got it memorized. Does sound kind of like, first year or second year med school stuff. So here we go. The priest looks upon this naga, this plague, in the skin of the flesh, and if the hair is turned white, the appearance is deeper than the skin, well, then it is Zara Ott, and he pronounces that. He says that this person is tamei, meaning unclean. And then if the bright spot is white in the skin of the flesh, and it's not deeper than the skin, and the hair doesn't turn white, then the priest shuts this guy up that has the plague, the naga, for 7 days. Seventh day, he checks on him, and he says, "Behold, if the plague is stayed, hasn't spread," then he shuts him up for 7 more days, looks again, and now if it's starting to dim and hasn't spread, he will pronounce him. "It ain't nothing till I calls it." He pronounces him clean, tahor. It's just a scab. He washes his clothes, and he is clean. But if the scab has spread, and he shows himself again, the priest looks, and it has spread. Then he pronounces that he is, in fact, tamei, and it is Zara Ott. So when this naga is in a man, he is brought to the priest, looks, and we get more and more descriptions. There's a white uprising in the skin, and it's turned with white hair. There's raw flesh in the uprising. If it's an old Zara Ott in the skin of the flesh, then he is, again, unclean. And he doesn't shut him up this time. He's just plain unclean. If the plague has broken out abroad and it's covered all of the skin of him from his head to his feet, well, the priest looks, behold, he pronounces him, once it's done, unclean, or he pronounces, and if he's all white, he can be clean. But if there's raw flesh, then he is unclean. So we got this whole thing. The priest's going to basically look. Sometimes there's a waiting period. And the general concept is there are lots of descriptions of, you know, the contents of the scab or raw flesh or what the colors of the hair are like, whether it's raising or sunken. And ultimately, if it spreads, it's not good. And at the end of the various periods of time when he is set apart, the priest either pronounces him unclean, because it is in fact the negah, he is tameh, or if it doesn't spread, then he can be pronounced clean. When a man or a woman has a plague upon the head or upon the beard, too, he looks at it, behold, if the appearance is deeper than the skin, if it's yellow, thin hair, pronounces him unclean, a skull, it's a zara'at on the head or of the beard. He looks upon the nagah, the plague of that skull, and sees whether or not it's deeper than the skin, no black hairs in it. Then he shuts him up that has the nagah, the skull, for 7 days. Again, seventh day, he looks on it, checks to see whether it's spread or not. If in this case there's no yellow hair and it's not deeper than the skin, then he gets shaved. You don't shave the place where the skull is. And he shuts him up, the one that has this thing, for 7 more days. Again, looks on it, sees whether it's spread. And if it hasn't, and if it's not deeper than the skin, okay. You can be pronounced clean, and he will wash his clothes and be clean. But if it spreads, right, that's not the good thing. We'll pause here, because what I want to do is look ahead. We're going to talk more about some of this next week, and we're going to see that essentially what happens when people have this nagah is that they're to be put outside the camp. Most everybody remembers this. It's seen some of the movies from the 60s when they used to make movies based on the Bible, that he is unclean. He is tumah. And they would actually shout in the Hebrew. They would shout, unclean, unclean. They were set apart. They were sent out. The same word, a shalak, that's used in the case of being sent out in the process of a separation between a husband and a wife. I've already mentioned the fact that there is a real similarity here between this idea of death as in a corpse. As I read through some of the descriptions, hope that makes some of it clear, right? Think about the things that we're talking about here and what the priest is looking for. Think about what happens to a corpse. Thankfully, probably most of us haven't had as much experience on that score unless we're a medical examiner or a med student or something like that. But I am told, at least, there is a whole lot that seems really similar here. Where it gets interesting are some of the related things. And again, this is what we'll talk about more last week. But I'm going to just kind of use this as a teaser. We have a description of what is to be done at the end of this period of time. And basically, it involves a number of things. A couple of birds, one of which is going to be left alive, one of which is going to be killed. The blood of that bird is going to be put in an earthenware vessel. And then we're going to have three particular things. See if this rings a bell as I'm going through it. The blood, there will be a cedar wood, piece of wood that will be dipped along with hyssop. Hyssop. Where have we heard all of this before? And then there's a 7-day period. Maybe the other clue here is found in this understanding. I've used the word nagah, plague, a number of times. It appears in the description having to do with zara'at a bunch of places. But there's only one other place outside of this section where the word is used at all. Turns out that's in Exodus chapter 11, verse 1. And it has to do with, yeah, you got it, a nagah, a plague. As a matter of fact, it's a very specific plague. It's the 10th plague, the last one. Ah, the death of the, what is a corpse of a firstborn look like, I wonder. Think it might be at least remotely similar to what the plague of Zara'at looks like? Anyway, it says, one more nagah, one more plague will I bring upon the Egyptians in Exodus 11, 1. It's the only place that that word is used elsewhere in the Torah. And then it says what? Well, what happens to the Zara'at person, the person who has Zara'at? The name for them is the Metzora. Answer, they're shipped out. They're shipped out of the camp. After this one more nagah, that Moshe is told Yahuwah will bring on the Egyptians, what are they going to do? They're going to shellac you all. They're going to send you out. And when you put the other pieces in here, the hyssop, the blood, the cedar wood, I got to admit, as the Rambam, Maimonides, famously pointed out, he's probably, I don't even know if he's the first, but he's certainly one of the most famous. Lots and lots of other folks have noticed it since. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. It does look a lot like what we saw at that same period of time associated with that 10th plague. Right? How are we going to avoid the 10th plague? Little hyssop, some blood. Over the doorposts. It does, in other words, look a whole lot like the description of Pesach. I will suggest to you that there's no coincidence in Scripture, and that there's a lot more to this than is generally assumed. And clearly, I've been kind of trying to be somewhat circumspect as I lay this out, but let me be real clear here. Now, this portion begins with new life. It begins with the description of life and the fact that even in life, there is an element of uncleanness for a certain period of time. And then it immediately goes into this thing that seems so completely opposite. Well, I guess you'd have to say it is. Death. And how it happens is the subject of, study, speculation, argument, but ultimately I do think the dots connect pretty well. Lashon hara, haughtiness, the evil tongue, literally murder by tongue, if you want to think about it that way. And out of that comes this plague, and it looks a lot like death. And what's the eventual solution for when the plague is stayed and there is cleanness and then there are offerings made for it? Yeah, it looks a whole lot like how it is that the 10th plague was stayed that was associated with the death of the firstborn. And you can pretty well connect the dots and say there's really something interesting here, isn't there? So for the time being, I'm going to just ask it as we wrap it up this way. One of the other things that we see throughout this idea of Zara'at and the person who is the Metzora, well, it's a question. Do you make teshuvah? The leper, no, the person with Zara'at, the Metzora, is told to make teshuvah. In the meanwhile, they're put outside the camp while they supposedly, hopefully, prayerfully, learn the lesson. What's the lesson? You're moving in a direction that ends up looking a whole lot like a corpse. Like death. Turn around, guess what? You're moving in the direction of life. It's the question that we all have to ask. Choose this day whom you will serve. Choose life. It's the simple two-word essence of all of Torah. Are we moving towards death or are we moving towards life? Life and death are also in the tongue. Seems like I read that somewhere in here too. And all of that fits. All of that makes sense. So even if people tell me this is an old stuff, doesn't happen, doesn't have any relevance to us today, I'm thinking, what? You mean the whole idea of how life and death and the power of the tongue are somehow associated and how we ought to be moving towards life and not towards death? That doesn't still have application? Now, as we begin to wrap it up, I guess this time I'm going to just ask it as a question. Okay, if this thing that we are told, well, doesn't exist anymore, is gone, is it medical science that was able to fix it? I don't think so. Because medical science doesn't even really know how to translate this. We know that, again, Hansen's disease ain't it. Medical science didn't come up with a vaccination for Zara'at. Something else is going on here. Is it nailed to the cross? Is it done away with? Well, maybe, but I'm not going to necessarily make that claim. What I'm going to claim is something that, this is Markology. This is my take. See if it doesn't fit. You know what, folks? I'm not unique in this. I won't claim that this is my observation. I'm sure there are other people that have said it, and I've probably heard it a number of times. I just can't remember exactly when or where. But the people that will point out, yeah, we haven't seen this for a long time. Maybe a long, long time. I wonder why. Have sometimes asked the question, you know, is it just possible that Zara'at is a blessing in disguise? Isn't it better to be told that you're moving towards death before, in fact, you get there? It's a way of letting people realize what's going on so there's time to make the change. It's almost, in other words, like this is a feedback mechanism that the creator of the universe provided for us. Hey, maybe while we were in the land, maybe while we were at least to some degree obedient, maybe in exile, he suggests. Maybe it doesn't apply in exile. Maybe, like I've already said, we got so much stinking Lashon Hara, a whole society that's infested with it. How can you get outside that camp anyway? Again, more questions than answers, but it's a spiritual malady that I have one more question to ask. Do you think we might see it again at some point? Do you think it might be the kind of a feedback mechanism that might be helpful? And by the way, if we're talking, and we'll talk in the news for in a few minutes about other things that might befall a nation which forgets him, from nuclear war to, as they say, NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical attacks. Is it that far-fetched to imagine a world when there's a whole lot of stuff running around, whether you call it the attack of the zombies or whatever, that looks a lot like Zaraat? Somehow or other, here's what I'm really trying to suggest, folks, and we'll leave it at this. I read through this. I see this description of all of these things and the things at the Kohen. And by the way, we don't necessarily even have an active set of, sons of Levi around today to do this and to declare Tahor and Tameh. But nevertheless, well, wouldn't it make sense? Wouldn't it be nice if we had some feedback mechanism that we don't have? Is it possible we'll get it? I don't know. But I do know that there is a choice to be made between life and death. And I know that there is some value in understanding this. And I've also got the real strong feeling that it is going to be made more and more clear. And we're probably going to get to see it, whether that's good or not. I have a strong suspicion depends on whether it's people that are willing to read what his word says and take the lessons to heart. And for those that don't, what's the point of the feedback mechanism that tells you that you're heading towards death anyway, right? So we'll pause there. One last comment, I guess, and that is that the last few verses of this chapter also have to do with the fact that a garment can get this stuff too. And similar kinds of things apply. When this plague of Zaraat is in a garment, whether it's wool or linen in the warp or the woof, or anything, or in a skin, or anything made out of skin, like your fur coat, and if it's greenish or reddish, the warp or the woof, then it is this thing called Zaraat, the Negah of Zaraat. And you show it again to the Kohen. He does the same thing, and he shuts it up for 7 days and looks upon it. And it all sounds very similar. It's kind of fascinating, in other words, that this stuff, this Zaraat, can even get into the coverings that people wear. The last verse, though, says this. This is the Torah of the Negah of Zaraat, whether it's in a garment of wool or linen or in the warp or the woof or of anything made out of skin, and that, I guess, includes people that have skin, and ultimately it is to be pronounced clean or to be pronounced unclean. Tomorrow morning we'll talk about the rest of the double portion, and more particularly why a few trivial things like the difference between the clean and the unclean and even life and death might still matter.